If you can't hear me. We've had, sometimes in the past, some people at certain locations in this room have difficulty hearing. So what I would ask you to do is, if you cannot hear our speaker, raise your hand and go like this, okay? Is that rude or anything? The most likely to have that problem are going to be you folks over there and you folks over there. So we'll watch. But anyway, that's an introduction. My name is Carla Bellinger, and I'm the Vice President of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron. And the purpose of our organization is to bring the best Catholic thinkers, teachers, and leaders to Akron on a monthly basis to promote a better understanding of significant issues impacting church, family, work, and community life. And so we're here once a month. Today's topic is the role of government in moral issues. And if you have a cell phone that is still turned on, please silence it now. And I say that to you, and I remember mine is on in my bag. At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce Rob Yanko, who will give our invocation. Rob?
Let us pray. Give us, O God, leaders whose hearts are large enough to match the breadth of our own souls. And give us souls strong enough to follow leaders of vision and wisdom. In seeking a leader, let us seek more than development for ourselves, though development we hope for, more than security for our own land, though security we need, more than satisfaction for our wants, though many things we desire. Give us the hearts to choose the leader who will work with other leaders to bring safety to the whole world. Give us leaders who lead this nation to virtue without seeking to impose our kind of virtue on the virtue of others. Give us a government that provides for the advancement of this country without taking resources from others to achieve it. Give us insight enough ourselves to choose as leaders those who can tell strength from power, growth from greed, leadership from dominance, and real greatness from the trappings of grandiosity. We trust you, great God, to open our hearts to learn from those to whom you speak in different tongues, and to respect the life and words of those to whom you entrusted the good of other parts of this globe. We beg you, great God, give us the vision as a people to know where global leadership truly lies, to pursue it diligently, to require it to protect human rights to everyone, everywhere. We ask these things, great God, with minds open to your word and hearts that trust in your eternal care. Amen.
Just before the talk starts, there are cards on your tables for questions. And after Denise's talk, we will collect those cards. So if, for instance, as she's speaking, you have a question, know where those are and be ready to fill those out. I would like to now introduce Judge John Quinn, who will introduce today's speaker.
Good afternoon. It's my privilege today to introduce our speaker, Denise McCura. Denise, Attorney McCura received her Juris Doctor degree in 1977 from Cleveland State, Cleveland Marshall's College of Law, and is licensed to practice law in Ohio, Illinois, and before the U.S. Supreme Court. She has served on the boards of the Chicago Volunteer Legal Services, the National Lawyers Association, St. Joseph's School in Chicago, and as a member of the Illinois State Bar Association's Individual Rights and Civil Liberties. In addition to legal counsel to the Ohio House Reference Committee, her professional experience includes teaching government, political science, as well as other courses at several colleges, a private law practice, directing government relations programs for nonprofit associations, and establishing a free legal clinic on the Near West Side of Chicago. She is currently the president of Human Family Research Center, an organization dedicated to advancing human rights, and is engaged in the private practice of law, particularly on behalf of pregnant women. Denise.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, this topic, government's role in morals, seems really ponderous, doesn't it? I mean, it seems like something you would run into in a course. Am I not? Is that better? Okay, good. I'm short, so. but it seems like something you'd run into in a political science course or government or something like that. But in reality, what this topic is, more people, okay. Is there a way to turn it up? Is this better? Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
All right. people usually don't complain when they can't hear me. I don't know. But in reality, it's a discussion of the human condition, isn't it? You know, what kind of human condition do we want to surround us and our families and our workplace? What is it that we expect of that? That's what this is really a discussion of. It's not some ponderous theoretical. It's what are we faced by day to day? You know, we make decisions every day when we roll into a parking space or when we get up in the morning or when we, you know, who knows what, walk out the door and take the wrong newspaper. There are moral decisions that we make all the time. And so what this talk is about is trying to figure out how we get the moral conditions for a democracy that we live in. That's what we're talking about. So, three branches of government. We all know we have a dysfunctional national legislature, and if I took a survey, I would guess that 80% of you at least would agree with that. Maybe 97%, I don't know. It's, you know, would waver between those two. We also have the other branches. We do have our judicial branch, which ends up discussing a lot and deciding on a lot of the moral decisions that are out there. And so we do have the importance of the court. And frequently, the court does get it wrong. We've had decisions from the Supreme Court, as you all know, that have allowed slavery, that have allowed the transport of Japanese Americans to internment camps. And the Supreme Court said that was okay. It said compulsory sterilization was okay at one time. So we have a Supreme Court that's been overruled at least 100 times. It's actually a little bit more than 100 times, but, you know, 100 is bad enough. So we do get it wrong on these morals issues. We change our minds about things, and I'm going to show you some graphic demonstrations of that in a few minutes. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to take the system apart. We're going to look at it in its pieces. I happen to live with a 2-year-old. And any of you who have familiarity with 2-year-olds know their main goal in life is to take everything apart, open every door. They attempt to put things back together, but I still find shoes in with the pots and pans and all sorts of other... But he's learning. He's taking it apart. So we're going to take the 2-year-old approach today because that is what we need to do, not just today, but as a constant matter to figure out if what we're doing, what we're saying, what we're thinking does fit in. Now, the government is, we'll take that first. Now, our government, as you know, is a democratic republic. It's not a direct democracy. We vote for people who then make the decisions. What if the government didn't get involved in moral issues? What if it was contrary to the topic of this speech? What if they just let everybody do whatever they wanted to do? You would end up with anarchy, right? Because there have to be some rules. When you get to that end of your block and there's a stop sign, okay, no one's around, do you still stop? Are you tempted not to stop? But that law's there. I'm tempted, I can tell you. But, you know, the same thing, obviously, for murder and so many other laws that we have out there. They're there to protect us from anarchy. so that we can live together in community, so we can flourish as a human community if we don't have some of those regulations in place. The government is concerned with pragmatic issues of infrastructure, and that pretty much means everything, as well as what we expect of each other. What are our aspirational expectations of each other? How do we expect to treat each other in a democracy? What is it that we think we have to have as the basic bottom line? Because obviously we're not going to regulate every little thing. Sometimes it does feel that way, but not regulate everything. What is the ideal? The right to live, work, raise a family in a community that reflects our deepest moral and personal concerns. Isn't that the ideal that we have? Because I think we have to start with what we're after. So we want a community that reflects all of those things. One of the researchers that has been taking a look at partisanship throughout the country is saying that people, and one of the reasons we have such extreme partisanship now is because people are moving to communities where people think and act like them. So evidently all the Republicans are going over here and all the Democrats are going over there, and I don't know where the independents are. So, but you know, it's I don't know if that's true, but that's what the recent research has found. Now, in the United States government, there are two places that reflect those aspirations. One is our Constitution, and one is the Declaration of Independence. Since the Declaration of Independence came first, I will read, and I know you've heard this a thousand times before, but I always think it bears repeating. We hold these truths. Now, the Declaration of Independence, as you probably know, is a very long document that talks about all the grievances from the British at the time. Every 4th of July, my 9-year-old, now 9-year-old grandson, and I get together, and we read that in the flag in our front yard in a very angry tone of voice, because they were angry at the British, so he likes doing the angry tone of voice. So, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. You ready for this? Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure those rights, governments are instituted among men. This is the justification for having our government, our democratic republic, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now that's very important, because as we confront new moral challenges, this is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to derive that direction from the consent of the governed. That's us. You know, we need to have that role in place. Now, the Constitution, again, it's not in place to let people do whatever they want to do. It's in place to put in place what they need as a community. The preamble to the United States Constitution: we the people of the United States, in order to form, and this is where the list starts of what we think are the basic moral requirements to fit us all together, that we can live in a community, to form a more perfect union, establish justice. That was one of the biggest, one of the first things they said, is to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Good luck with that, right? But that's a goal. That's a goal. It's an aspiration. Promote the general welfare. You notice how vague all of these are? They do set up. These are our goals, but they are all fairly vague. Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and posterity. Do ordain and establish the Constitution for the United States of America. So we want to encourage virtues, basically, that are needed to maintain a democracy. What are those virtues? As the wonderful person that did the wonderful invocation said, we don't want to impose our sense of virtues, all of our sense of virtues, on someone else. You know, but what are those basic ones that we need to hold our democracy together? That's what we're after, not every little thing. You know, some people consider cleaning the snow out of their driveway as a virtuous act. You know, so we don't want to impose that on everyone, all the virtuous things that we think people should have. Now, when it comes to human rights, because you figure the way they talk about it, it's life and liberty. Pursuit of happiness is really part of pursuit of liberty, right? So life and liberty that have to be in balance. Those are the two key things. What are those individual rights? That's one of the questions we have to ask ourselves all the time. What are those individual rights that we need to maintain in order to maintain our democracy? Obviously, the ancient Greeks had an idea of that. many people attribute to the Catholic Church and their reliance on individual human dignity as forming the basis for the people who then, Locke and Rousseau, who then helped to design our ultimate system of a democracy. But the basis is in that individual human dignity, which we as Catholics definitely do believe in. What qualifies as a human right in today's culture? My organization has a website, humanfamilyresearch.org. There's actually a sign-up sheet over there if you want to get the monthly missives. And it's a question of, what do you include in there? There's so many things out there. You know, we have sections on bullying and trafficking and all of the mistakes of the Supreme Court and, you know, all of the things to do with pregnant women and how they're discriminated against and the life of children, including unborn children, and all of the evidence and facts that there are out there. You know, we're going to start a section on elder abuse. So, you know, there's a widespread, in fact, it was Elder Abuse Day a couple of weeks ago. I didn't realize that there was actually a day to try to recognize and motivate people to do more about elder abuse. In my law practice, I've had some situations that involve elder abuse, so I know how real it is and how horrendous it is when you think of someone who is innocent and disabled and can't do anything and how they're being abused. But what qualifies as a human right? You know, what is it? You know, when are your human rights being violated? I think when somebody cuts me off on the freeway, my human rights are being violated. But then again, living in Chicago for a period of time, I have a more aggressive style of driving, so it's probably my fault most of the time. Okay, so that's, we know what the role of government is, or what we want it to be, what it should be. What is morality? What are we talking about? Well, basically, when we're talking about morality, we're saying knowing right from wrong, right? Isn't that at its core what morality is? We know right from wrong. I'm very fond of a quote by Hubert Humphrey, who said in the discussions of the 1964 civil rights law, during that debate, he said, "You don't have to be a lawyer to understand the do unto others as you would have them do unto you." You know, that's a no-brainer. That's something that doesn't matter level of education or ability or anything else. That core principle is still there. I do miss Hubert. He was a good man. But morality isn't just a matter of what you believe in. It's not just a matter, because remember, I'm not talking about religion here. I'm talking about morality, basic morality. Morality has to be based on truth, doesn't it? I mean, you can't just make stuff up. You know, the people that flew into the Twin Towers on 9/11, they thought they were doing the right thing. They were trying to destroy a culture that they saw as destroying their culture. To them, it was more of a self-defense, as I recall from the time. That was their purpose, was to damage American culture. That's what they wanted to do. So those were their beliefs, and they acted on them. What was the truth? What role did the truth play in that? So every time we have one of these new issues, we have to go back to morality is tied to some truths. And of course, the most important truths are those that have to deal with human dignity. Now, one of the questions that is often asked, and I think Catholics ask particularly, is can you have those truths? Can you understand that truth? Can you even have a desire to have morality without some basis in faith? Do you need that? Can you have something? Can there be an enlightenment view of, I'm a moral person, I want to do the right thing, but I don't practice religion at all? Can atheists, can agnostics have that sense of morality? Well, I've known people who, and I'm sure you all have, who are not religiously inclined, don't practice any faith, may have been raised a certain way, but don't practice any faith, and I still consider them to be very moral people. So for today's talk, I'm going to put that question aside of whether or not faith is what you need in order to have a moral foundation. But that question is still out there, and I think it does need to be pursued. Now, the basics are equality of all human beings, and that's where our equal protection it's odd to me that equal protection wasn't included in the Constitution. It's in the Bill of Rights. But equal protection comes from the equality that people do expect. So it is immoral to discriminate, which of course was the counter to slavery and the promotion, the basis for the promotion of civil rights for folks. That was all in there. But it is understanding that is ordered to a body of objective truths, not subjective beliefs. And that topic has come up in the Hobby Lobby case, but I will get to that in a minute. Now, based on a shared idea of human flourishing in a just community, what are we talking about here? We're talking about morality. What kinds of virtues will create this moral ecology? That's something else that people have used, a term that people have used. What is the moral ecology, and how do we foster that moral ecology in order to provide for an understanding of and pursuing of moral truths? What are the basic moral necessities? I read once the basic moral necessities are sort of like basic health necessities. We have certain basic health necessities, right? We need a certain amount of water. We shouldn't have too much sugar. Those cookies, I see a lot of these cookies still on the table. You must be following that advice. but, you know, there are basic health necessities. Well, in order to live in a democracy, there are basic moral necessities. I compiled a list. It's open for debate. There are many things that I think we could add to it. Civility would be one. You know, we have a basic, again, when I'm driving around in my car, I'm not always very civil. But basically, I think, one-to-one conversations, we have to have a basic level of civility. We have to be willing to talk to each other, which sometimes does seem missing in Washington. But there has to be that basic civility, that basic respect for the other person as having the same human dignity that we do. Honesty, that's a big one, and that's tough because we seem to have wandered from what does the truth mean. Consideration for others. So when you go through life, you're not just thinking about what's good for me, but what's good for everyone at my table, what's good for everyone in my community. So it's that basic level of consideration. Self-discipline. I think that is one of the things that we have to have as well, because we don't just get to do whatever we want to do. Well, okay, unless you're two, then, you know, he gets to do whatever he wants to do. Integrity is something else, to act with integrity, with the best intentions, with the best to really examine our own intentions. And respect for human life and human dignity, that's at a core, that's core to our common culture, our common morality, our common government. Courage, takes a lot of courage these days, doesn't it? To stand up for what's right, to talk to people when they've done something wrong. I was watching a VeggieTales back in March about Esther, Queen Esther, and the whole concern was, well, how do I have courage to tell the king this? You know, how do I have the courage to tell a friend she shouldn't have stolen that apple? You know, we have to have a level of courage to speak out. We can't just stay in our own individual moral boxes and act morally ourselves. We do have to speak out. Self-sacrifice. And everybody in this room who is a parent or an aunt or a cousin or a friend knows the spirit of self-sacrifices. And of course, justice, that's the equal protection that we talked about earlier. Now, here comes the problem. What if we differ on what is needed for human flourishing? What if you have other things? What if there are things that you think are needed, and we see this reflected in the moral issues that we're confronting today. If there's no agreement, how do you make laws that reflect a common morality that holds us all together? You know, how do you do that? Now, just as an aside, supposedly this problem started, as it used to be, the church was in charge of morals and the state or the king was or queen was in charge of running the government and putting up the stop signs or whatever they did in Old England. And supposedly people trace back this confusion of church and state to when Henry VIII decided he was going to take over the church. Because then he was in charge of the moral side of stuff, the same way he was in charge of the stop signs. So you could say that we started this whole problem just to justify adultery. You know, I think that's kind of funny that it's sort of strange things happen in life. So the founders believed that there were common moral beliefs and that they were necessary. Not just me saying it. It was a necessary part of our democracy. And just to read a brief quote from Thomas Jefferson, "God who gave us life gave us liberty, and can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are a gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath." So clearly Thomas Jefferson thought in order to have a healthy democracy, in order for this experiment to succeed, there has to be that common moral understanding. Now, the rule of law, another point to bring up here is about the rule of law. We talked before about anarchy. The rule of law depends upon treatment based on an application of the law, an equal application of the law. We have a rule of law, and we all have to comply with that rule of law in our country. Otherwise, again, you have anarchy. What you do have also is, I do hear a quote from Aristotle, a political order depends on the presence of law, and law springs from man's understanding of a universal right and wrong, not a matter of private choice alone, although, of course, recognizing some freedom within that. But again, it's not every little detail. So you have Aristotle and you have Thomas Jefferson that are all saying that, that we need the common morality. We also have the influence of our market economy. I actually teach a course in economics, a college-level course in economics, so this always comes up of how our current market structure affects our development of morality. It's an interesting thing to talk about in an economics course. But you think about it, everything that we hear and see out in the market economy is you have this freedom of choose. You have a lot of choices, and we want it that way. That's the way a market economy works. Now, I'm not opposed to market economies. Okay, I think they've had some successes and certainly some negative outcomes for people, particularly at the lower income level. But actually, I think it hurts the people at the higher income level more because of the moral issue, but that's another topic. But essentially, you have a situation where we are a market economy based on choice, based on this is my free will, this is what I want to do. Well, naturally, that's going to leak over a little bit into our development of morality. In fact, when pro-choice folks first came out with the slogan pro-choice, I don't know if you remember going back into the 1980s, that slogan was stolen by a lot of companies who talked about choice. That was a big selling point. That was a big marketing point. So the market economy or whatever economy we have is going to impact. It's not in isolation. It's part of our everyday life. So that's going to affect our attitudes as well. And I guess I constantly try to examine my own conscience and figure out, okay, am I making this decision because I like the choice of this rather than that? I really don't need that to spend the money on that, but it's only because of this being convinced in a market economy I needed the latest smartphone, you know, to function, which is something a lot of us do think about now. The other problem that we have in our current culture is that many of our institutions have failed us. Many of our institutions, such as educational institutions, all of the child sex scandals in sports programs, our own church has failed us in failing to monitor and stop all of the child sex abuse that was going on. So we have a lot of our own institutions that we used to be able to rely on for, okay, we can always trust what the church says. You can always trust what Coach, I've forgotten the name of the guy at Penn State, you can always trust what they say. This is a reliable person. Okay, they wouldn't do anything to hurt my child. I'm turning my child over to them, and they're not going to do anything to hurt them. So you have, I don't need to mention the scandals in government, do I? Because obviously it's another example of places where, and it's not just the Catholic Church, by the way. I don't want to pick on the Catholics, because we've had a lot of evangelical ministers that have been exposed over the years as well. So I'm not just picking on the Catholics there. So that's one of the concerns that we have, is we no longer can rely on our basic institutions. George Weigel, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, said that a common understanding was once provided by mainstream Protestantism in this country. And I think the journal that he and Reverend Newhouse helped start, First Things, was trying to replace that common moral understanding by establishing this journal and inviting all sorts of different faiths to cooperate in that. The other thing we look at is religious affiliation. I'm looking for places where we can go to for that reinforcement of common moral understanding. That's what I'm after here. So where does that come from? And so far, I'm not doing a good job finding a place because so many of our institutions and theories have let us down. Religious affiliation is something that's often cited. And the recent polls do show a very clear decline in religious affiliation. In fact, there was a Pew Center Research Center Forum on Religion and Public Life from 2013 that shows that two-thirds of Americans think that religion has lost its influence, but they recognize that as a bad thing. It's like, we want that. We're not sure where to go to get it. It's interesting when you think about other times in our history where we have had great movement on a moral issue, such as slavery. So you think, well, that was a time that came out of the religious community, right? That was motivated by faith. It was motivated by a deep understanding of what morality is. So you had a period of time. Well, religious affiliation at that point was only at 30%. So it wasn't just religion. I'm not saying Lincoln, I don't think, President Lincoln didn't consider himself to be an overly religious person. So he had his own faith, but it wasn't an organized religion. So it's not just, and I'm not saying that to say bad things again about the Catholic Church, because I think I'm a very faithful Catholic myself and couldn't get on without it. But I don't think we can rely on that to provide us with all of that basic core moral understanding. Have we gotten to a culture where individual rights basically have trumped any common moral understanding because there is no source of it any longer? And I just pose that question to you. I don't have a lot of answers. I think it's important to ask the right questions, and that's what I'm hoping to do today. Yet, despite the fact that we may have lost some common moral understanding, we still have to come up with decisions on laws, right? We still are obligated to live each day, to make those decisions for ourselves and to make the decisions in a community. And by the way, it seems like bad news that I'm telling you, well, we're like, this is failing. But when you look around you, just look in this room, the number of you who are interested enough in this issue, which, like I said, seemed like a rather ponderous issue, to come to something like this. But look at all the good going on out there in the community, all the people who are volunteering, all of the institutions and organizations that are reaching out to people. There's a lot of that happening. So it's not that we have lost our way. It's just that needs to be resurrected. Somehow we need to bring that sense of community back, and I'll talk about that at the end. So we base our laws, as I said, on the Constitution of the United States. That's the core principle. Every law has to pass constitutional muster, or somebody's going to challenge it. So that's what we have as our core, and so many moral issues do end up with the Supreme Court. When we have a close question, we've had several of those that have come before the court. Whether you talk about same-sex marriage, religious freedom, abortion, a lot of these things. If there is no constitutional principle in play, there's nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the understanding, and I'm not an originalist like Justice Scalia, but if there is nothing there, what does the court do? How does it make that decision? How did it make the decision in Roe? What did it base it on? How do you get there? Well, one of the things that I absolutely agree with Justice Scalia on is that when there isn't anything there, and it's a close question and huge public difference of opinion, what happens? Where should it go? Should the court decide? Should the court be the people, unelected people, that represent our common moral understanding? Should we rely on the court to do that? And we both, I'm sure all of us, have agreed with some decisions, disagreed with others. No, those decisions should go back to the people. It should go back to us to decide what our common moral understanding is and exactly what in that common moral understanding is going to tell us how this law should be written, how these laws should be written, how our lives should be affected. If you don't do that, there is damage to democracy. And that's one of the key problems that results when you have a democracy, theoretically, but you're not allowing people to have a say in the rules that govern their lives. There is a problem. We lose faith in our democracy, and I think many of us have. Many of our young people have. There is a quote from Alexander Hamilton, who warned in the Federalist Papers that if you entangle the three branches of government like that, you undermine the democratic control of law, and it portends the end of liberty. And again, that has a lot more thought has to be given to that, but that is a concern, I think. I have a quiz for you. Who said this? The fatal habit of considering Christian morals as distinct from Christian doctrines insensibly gains strength, describing a period of time in history. Thus, the peculiar doctrines of Christianity went more and more out of sight, and as might naturally have been expected, the moral system itself also began to wither and decay, being robbed of that which should have supplied it with life and nutriment. Nutriment. Anybody want to take a wild guess? Okay, it was William Wilberforce. He was talking about the era. Of course, he was the man who first pushed through problems with the slave trade. So that is important to remember. This isn't the first time that we've been there. Now, when we talk about, I only have a few minutes left, when we talk about various issues that come before the court, I did want to talk briefly about abortion. My 4.3 minutes that I have left, because abortion represents an issue that presents the core challenge between life and liberty. Think about this. You're talking about life of a child. You can't get away from that. That child is there. But you're also talking about the freedom and autonomy of a woman, right? So it's a clash of those two rights. And what I would propose to you today is that when you look at that clash of rights, it's like, no wonder we're still divided 50-50 in this country on this topic, because we don't know which direction to go, and our basic core of our democracy is challenging us and calling us to take this on. So we have, in this situation, a need to re-understand what freedom is. Is this freedom just to do what's in my best interest? Is that what democracy is calling us to do, was founded on? No. It is calling on us to understand that freedom has to be understood within the community. And of course, in this case, the community includes the unborn child. So when you have that challenge between life and liberty, it's not a do what you want to do. I still remember my 7-year-old daughter a long time ago saying, you know, we're really not free, are we, Mom? And the truth is, we're not. There's so many restrictions placed on us by the laws and morality and everything else. So we have to understand that within that context, it is important. Now, one of the things I didn't get to was talking about where we go from here. And I think it's very important that we look at two things that are very familiar to Catholics, and that is hope and love. God wrote on each of our human hearts hope and love. It's in our human hearts. I was once part of a press conference down in Columbus, and there was a woman who had had 3 abortions. And the Fox News reporter said, okay, so they're marching in Washington, they say one thing, and you say another thing, which is the case? And she looked at him, didn't stop for a half a second, and said, God wrote the value of human life, human dignity, on every human heart, and that can't be taken away. And so that's in there. So now we have to ask ourselves, what is the loving response to a woman who is faced with a very difficult decision, has economic problems, because that's the major driver of women to abortion clinics. So how do you build a new moral consensus based on caritas, based on agape? How do you do that? How do you propose? I mean, it seems awfully hokey to just talk about it, right? And we do have to do more than talk about it. One quote, briefly. Frederick Douglass, he knew what a fight this was going to be, because I want to leave you in a fighting mood to fight for this culture of life and love that we need. Let me give you a word of philosophy of reform. The whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to our august claims have been born of earnest struggle. The conflict has been exciting, agitating, all-absorbing, and for the time being, putting all other tumults to silence. It must do this or it does nothing. We're in for a fight. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one. It may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. Find out just what people will submit to, and you have found the exact amount of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue until they are resisted with either words or blows or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress. One of my favorite quotes. We always have to be willing to fight. We're called to fight in a loving way as Catholics. But that's what we are called to do. And the other thing that is written on the human heart is a sense of hope. Pope John Paul II. I still have to get used to saying St. John Paul II. Or no, I guess it's not two then, it's just St. John. But at any rate, our saintly Pope has reinforced that message of hope over and over and over again, and we can't let go of it. What I did want to show you, and I'll take the veils off so you can see them afterwards, these are ads from the 1940s that promote things like giving Coke to babies, beer to women, saying that it's okay to abuse your wife. There's interesting, it shows that our sense of morality is not always what we would hope it to be. And we have to remember that that's part of our history as well. There was one time when people thought these things were okay. So I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to show them to you. I believe there is room at the table for everyone. The immigrant, the elderly, the abused, the trafficked, the unborn child, and the pregnant woman. There is room for them all at the table, and we are the ones that have to make room for them. And I thank you for inviting me to share your table today. Thank you.
Thank you, Denise, for that presentation. Well, you're going to have another 15 minutes for us to ask you questions, so I don't know. Maybe that could, if someone would like to write down a question about what's on that easel there, then she could simply use that as one of her questions. Our volunteers will be collecting the question cards in a few moments, so when you have your question written, if you could hold it up high so they could pick them up. And while you're working on the questions and picking up the questions, I have a few announcements. What's coming next month? Our next speaker in September will be Brad Malkowski, who is the Associate Professor of Comparative Theology from the University of Notre Dame. Brad's topic is Stories of a Catholic in Multicultural India. He is a funny and witty scholar of Hinduism, and he married into a Muslim family. And I would tell you, as a Catholic, he certainly has some things to tell. I personally had him as a professor at the University of Notre Dame for World Religions, and he had his students captivated about, for instance, his brother-in-law who had four wives, and how do you handle that at midnight, 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., especially when they don't know about each other. So I'm sure that story will come up. He's bringing his wife, who is was raised Muslim and has become Catholic. So that will be Friday, September 5th, here at the Quaker Station at 135 South Broadway in Akron. And how do you make a reservation for the First Friday Club? You can send a check for $15. To 795 Russell Avenue in Akron. You can make a reservation over the phone and then bring your money and give it to Carol when you get here. That phone number is on our website. We ask that you make your reservation. If you don't have a monthly subscription, we ask that you make your reservation by the evening of the Monday before the Friday presentation. And what if you miss one of our very inspiring talks? You can hear a podcast of each previous speaker from our website and click on the month that when they have spoken. I think we now have probably 4 years' worth of podcasts. So if you want to download them onto your exercise tape recorder and, you know, get on the treadmill and listen to a wonderful talk, that's also an opportunity for you. We also have an announcement today of thanks. We have several people who have women who have been integral to the success of the First Friday Club. And those of you who've been here for many years have seen their smiling faces when you walk in. I would like to recognize and acknowledge three women. I know at least some of them are here. They have been hostesses, and they're retiring as hostesses. They would be Pat Gerber, Mary Wolfman, and Diane Batico. Could you stand up, and we'll give you a big hand. I know the first time I came to First Friday Club, I saw these smiling faces, and I felt right at home. So, and one of them I had known previously. Any other announcements from board members? Anything I need to do, say? I would like to acknowledge anyone who is here for the first time. If you have never been to First Friday and this is your first time, please stand and we'll also acknowledge you. Would you do that, please? Thank you very much. Mike, are we ready for questions yet? Anybody else have one that's burning in your mind that you still want to write down? Okay. This is Mike Herbel, our secretary.
As was stated, if we have rule of law, if we do not have rule of law, otherwise we have anarchy. Do we then have anarchy in our southern borders because the government is not enforcing our current laws?
We don't have anarchy. We have lack of enforcement of the law is what we have. I mean, the questioner exactly repeated what the problem was. And, people disobey the law all the time. And in some cities, I lived in Chicago long enough to know that there are parts of that city where the law is ignored. And that's what happens. But it is still the rule of law. The rule of law, too, you have to consider is an ideal. Because everything that works into it is our human nature. And our human nature is always going to fight against that, right? So you're always going to have a certain amount of problem with that.
Is there room at the table for those of religious beliefs who do not consider life starting until after birth?
Well, I believe in the rule of law, but I also believe in the rule of love. And yes, of course there's room at the table for everyone, because every one of us has that human dignity. And it's my job to try to convince you that there is life that needs to be respected before birth. But yes, of course, definitely room at the table. Please come.
Some people today do not believe that there is no truth, right or wrong. How can society establish moral behavior in that kind of environment?
Well, I think the questioner hit the nail on the head. That's exactly the problem we have right now, is because we all want to believe in our own version of truth. And you know what? In a free society, that's okay, except on some basic questions. You know, the basic things that we talked about, the basic things that we decide are important enough to hold us together instead of splitting us apart. So there are some basic core issues that we need to agree on, mostly surrounding human dignity and human right to life, whether that's an elderly person or an unborn child. One of the things I didn't get to talk about, didn't have time to talk about, is our discrimination against children in general. Do you know that the time that you are most at risk of being murdered is right after you're born? You're 10 times more likely to die then. In court decisions that issue punishments for killing people, okay, to make it put it simple, the punishment for killing an adult is much higher than for killing a child. And, you know, you look at the child poverty statistics, child abuse, premature birth, all of these things. We don't respect children after birth. So how do we expect our culture to respect children before birth? There's so much work that we need to do. on the front of human dignity and making that a real battle cry for us. And it's not just with unborn children. Like I said, it's children after birth, except for my 2-year-old grandson, who's very well respected around my house. Oh, wait, it's his house. I forgot.
How do we strike a balance between civility and struggle?
Boy, that's a tough one, isn't it? Because we get our emotions going, we get our passions going, you know, and we want to just want to yell and scream and say, no, you can't believe that way. How could you possibly believe? And honestly, my only solution to that is prayer. Do I dare say that in public, in open? Is to pray that when I am confronted by that, the first thing that I start with always are questions, not telling them what they should think, not telling somebody, whether it's abortion, immigration, same-sex marriage, whatever it is. I want to know them. I don't want to know where they're coming from. That helps to diffuse, because, see, we all want to have a voice. That's what a basic calling is. That's what I'm talking about with why we need that in our democracy, why we need a role in making the rules that govern our lives. And it's the same thing with a one-on-one conversation. We have to show respect for that person if we expect them to show respect for what we're going to say. And I pray like heck that whatever words that person needs to hear, God, please let them come out of my mouth. They may not have gone through my brain first, but let them come out of my mouth. And so my big solution is prayer.
Where do we begin to develop a moral consensus on issues or on a particular issue?
We have to get off our smartphones and talk to each other. We don't talk to each other nearly enough. And I think with the next generation, I have 2 daughters in their 30s, and my 1 daughter in New York, I never even talk on the phone with her anymore. It's always texting. Forget email. That's old, too. It's texting. So, you know, how do you communicate? We have to make a conscious decision to talk to each other. Those difficult issues, when I was growing up in a family of 6, we weren't allowed to talk about anything controversial because at all costs, my mother wanted to avoid us 6 kids being in battle with each other. I can understand where she's coming from. But you have to talk about those difficult topics with your neighbors. You have to bring them up with your neighbors, with your friends, with family members. The critical thing, I understand the importance of LeBron James, but there really is more to life than LeBron James. I like LeBron James, but, you know. Now, baseball, that's a different... No, just kidding. But, you know, we need to be... That's where the courage comes in. We all need, prayerfully, to develop more courage to reach out to each other as a beginning of forming that new community based on Caritas.
Could you reflect upon the role or power of the media in moral issues?
Well, this is interesting because we kind of have 2 types of media going on today. We have the traditional media, right? We have the traditional media that is has a lot of messages, and depending on which shows I listen to NPR off and on all day, and they give me a certain attitude. I read both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, so I can get somewhat of a balanced view of what's going on. But the other media that's going on is the Internet. I mean, there's tons of stuff on the Internet, reaching out to people in a new way. And some people thought that that would be a help for democracy, but now they have this, I guess there's some new problems with the technology and that it's possible to screen out some things. So I'm not sure the technology, I'm not a technical person at all. But that's a different kind of media that's going on, is the Internet. We're going, I guess, going more to Internet TV, not the traditional TV channels. There's all sorts of things happening. We have to keep on top of that. The whole social media issue, you know, reaching out to people through social media, people that have 2,000 friends for their Facebook page. Do they really have 2,000 friends, I ask you? I figure in life, if you're blessed enough to have 2 or 3 good friends, that you're very rich indeed. But I do think that we are certainly poisoned. There are certainly things that we hear on the evening news that are phrased in a certain way. I would use as an example the Kermit Gosnell case from Pennsylvania, the man who was abusing a lot of women in his abortion facility. That barely made the news, even though you're talking about hundreds of women. Now, I'll also mention to you, I'm involved in a case locally of a forced abortion. This was an abortion facility up in Cleveland that has now thankfully closed, where the physician involved was telling his patients, oh, you're not fit to be a mother. You have to have this abortion, and pushing, refusing to stop, even when they said stop. So, you know, you have a media that is going to portray these places as safe havens, and that's not always the case. I'm sure there are some where there are doctors who, while I don't agree with what they do, are trying to do a good job as a doctor, but there are many who don't, and we're afraid of that. We are almost afraid to talk about some issues because they are so divisive, and particularly abortion, since we have this 50-50 split that's been going on for a long time. That's why we need to take from both sides. You know, there's a radical group at each end that you're never going to change their minds. They're never going to change each other's minds. But the vast majority of us, we want a better world. We want a better way. We want to help both the unborn child and the parents. And I say pregnant woman, but it's the parents. It's both of them. You know, we want to create an environment that is protective for both of them. So, you know, when I think about the media, I think of what their needs are in terms of their business model, and they are all businesses, right? Even NPR, you know, there's a certain business element there. So they're trying to do what enhances their business, and we're going to see that coming up very soon with the political season warming up, right? And all the ads that pick and choose and don't give you the full, you know, we've all been through that, right? So I never trust anything I see in a political ad, frankly. But it's a way of using marketing. In my economics class, one of the things that I go through with my students, because I teach it to, it's a college-level course that I teach to a group of high school senior girls at an Orthodox Jewish high school in Beechwood. Takes me a long time to get all that out. But I bring in, there have been marketing books written about Hitler. How did Hitler convince the Germans to go along with this? He used branding. He used all these marketing techniques. You know, he treated it as a business. This is how I'm selling this idea. Well, I'm saying to myself, okay, if Hitler could convince people to do that, then why can't we use the same techniques to reach out to people with honesty and integrity and civility in building a different kind of culture? One thing I have to mention, too, that I didn't get a chance to say in my talk is what something I call the Schnickelgruber effect. We don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? What events, what things are going to happen. And so often we work towards something and something happens and it just magically. One thing, the destruction of the Berlin Wall, which probably most of you know, happened as a fluke because some minor German official declared the borders open. Now, if movements hadn't been building in Eastern Germany for years and years and years, the Berlin Wall would not have come down, right? People were ready to take advantage of that opportunity. But nobody knew that was going to happen. That wasn't planned. Well, Hitler's father was born with the last name of Schnickelgruber. Now, can you hear anybody saying Heil Schnickelgruber? I don't think so. Okay, so sometimes a little fluky thing like that, I like to think of as intervention from one power or the other coming out in our lives. But so we can't, in our human existence, we have to do what we're called to do and play the role that we're called to play. That's how we're going to make a success out of this, take advantage of those opportunities to reach out to somebody else with love. I would challenge you, if there is to be a culture of life, which, by the way, there's a phrase for that in the liberal community called the abundant community. Same basic concept, liberal and conservative, right? We agree on that. Just like moral relativism, the conservative community translates to primitive individualism, according to Mario Cuomo. Can't get more liberal than that, right? That's what they taught. So there's both sides are agreeing on this problem that we have. So what we need to do is challenge ourselves. What would a culture of life, what would Summit County look like if there were a culture of life here? What would be different in Summit County, in your neighborhood, what would be different? And I challenge you to think about culture of life isn't just some term coined by a pope. It's something that we have a responsibility every moment, every day of our lives to build. So I think I got off the question, but at any rate, thanks.
Carla? Mm-hmm. Ask her if she wants to comment on the posters.
Do you want to comment on the posters? Do we have... Where's our timer? How's our timer?
We're done.
We're done. Okay, so we all have a mandate to go from here to build a flourishing community in wherever we are. So I thank you for your inspiring talk. I would like to introduce Catherine Adamick. Am I pronouncing that right? Executive Director of Catholic Charities Community Services of Summit County and the First Friday Club board member who will lead us in our closing prayer.
Let us pray. O God, our Creator, all life is in your hands, from conception until death. Help us to cherish our children and to reverence the awesome privilege of our share in creation. May all people live and die in dignity, love, and virtue. May our elected officials make their decisions with high moral standards. Bless all of us who defend the rights of the unborn, the handicapped, and the aged. Enlighten and be merciful toward those who fail to love, and give them peace. Let freedom be tempered by responsibility, integrity, and morality. In this we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you all for coming. We hope to see you on September 5th. Have a good last of summer.